It's more about allowing those buildings to come back to life and to survive and to find out what those buildings want to become if they get to survive for another 100 years or 200 years.
Richard Neutra's Singleton House in LA's Mulholland Drive is a stateside modernist icon, but it was until rather recently a disheveled one. We talk tasteful revivals and why some architects shy away from building beautifully with Tim Campbell, principal of the architectural design studio of the same name, today on Section D. This is Section D, Monocle's weekly design show, and I'm your host, Josh Fennett. Also on today's Architecturally Enlightened show.
It's actually more than a network, a platform. It's a system where we try to create environment for institutions, for practicing architects, for researchers, curators, to exchange.
We'll hightail it to our TARDIS for a visit to the Future Architecture Festival, conveniently held in one of Europe's best destinations for bikes and buildings, Ljubljana. And
architecture as a control of mass. And in this case, communist governments and Tito allowed to the individuals to have, in this case, possibility to generate individual economies.
As the city's biennial reaches its final month, we'll look at a project confronting the past, present and future of the built environment in Slovenia. That's all to come on Section D on Monocle 24. First up now, we set sail for Slovenia. The Future Architecture Exhibition describes itself as the first Europe-wide platform of architecture museums, festivals and producers. And with 18 members from 15 different countries, its goal is to nurture the next generation of talent, as well as making architecture more sympathetic and understandable to those of us that use buildings as well as build them. So last week's Future Architecture Festival in Ljubljana was an opportunity for some of Europe's younger practitioners to exchange ideas about the future of a discipline often dominated by institutions, veterans and jargon-touting professors. Monocle's correspondent Guy Delaunay dropped in to hear about the philosophy behind the Future Architecture Forum.
There's a distinct buzz in the courtyard of Ljubljana's Museum of Architecture and Design, where delegates from across Europe are taking a break between sessions at the Future Architecture Festival.
It's actually more than a network, a platform. It's a system where we try to create environment for institutions, for practicing architects, for researchers, curators, to exchange.
Mateusz Czelek is the director of the Museum of Architecture and Design, which just so happens to be the coordinating entity behind the Future Architecture platform.
It's addressing the up-and-coming generation of architects and professionals. And we wanted to bring in the ideas, thinking about the future, because we are looking at the projects that are complete and we are trying to evaluate them. That's what happens mainly in the architectural media now. So we wanted to bring in the ideas and talking about the future and try to envision what should be done.
Is this perhaps an indication that you think, or within the platform, is a feeling that architecture up to this point had got to a stage where it was actually failing the very people that was meant to benefit, i.e. the people who live in cities?
Yes, we could say that as well. Through the projects that people present in the platform, we could say that architecture is again grasping a more solid ground.
And you're trying to make architecture comprehensible to ordinary people, and a lot of people can be bamboozled by the technical language that architects and designers use. So what are you trying to do to make architecture more relevant to people who don't have that sort of technical grounding in it?
Now, looking back at the projects that happened in the past 2 years, I think working on site with people, it's even more valuable. So people can feel why these people are there and what they are doing, and they can also, in a mutual debate and exchange, understand why we need architecture. The generation of architects that is coming, it has more empathy, it's socially aware. In the platform, people are really thinking about how architecture can help society. They want to address the most pressing issues of our time. Issues of inequality, issues of migration, of pollution, climate change. That's a trend in other professions as well. We became more aware of what are the consequences of our actions. But it's good to see that happening in architecture as well.
Future Architecture has 18 institutional members from a total of 15 countries, but its reach is wider than that. It offers an opportunity for young architects from around the world, or indeed anyone with an interest in architecture, to answer the open call for project ideas. The successful applicants are then matched with one of the institutional members to carry out their projects.
But since the matchmaking conference back in February, we have met many people and we have made good friends all around Europe, and you can see some of them.
Fanny Costuru personifies the cross-border nature of future architecture. She and her two colleagues are from Greece, based in London, and got the chance to work with the Belgrade International Architecture Week. Their project was perfectly suited to the war-damaged, economically ravaged Serbian capital. Activate modern ruins.
We've been working on ruins for a very long time. We have these kind of like derelict infrastructures, abandoned. I mean, with the crisis, it's all over the place, right?
And it seems that one of the common themes of the Future Architecture platform is that this isn't architects handing things down from Mount Olympus as unimpeachable wisdom, but it is very much about not just consulting the public, but interacting with the public and taking ideas from the public.
Yes, I mean, this is like a trend that is happening over the last years. It's all about what the people think, what the communities want, how to work with them. Participatory urban design processes are really flourishing, and everyone is encouraged to use them because the top-down is dead. The top-down has already failed, and we have seen that failing in the past. It's also not only a result of the past failures, but also it's the result of the socioeconomic crisis that is happening everywhere in the world. Because actually, architects find out that there's no budget anywhere. So people think outside of the box, think of new ways how to do things without money, and how to involve, you know, work with the resources of people, human resources, rather than, you know, economic resources.
How do you think you've grown as an architect, but perhaps also as a human being, over the past 9 months?
It has been a great change, mainly because you realize that what you're doing is very relevant to what other people are doing. It broadens your mind in the sense of like, oh, I haven't thought that, or what about that? And, oh, he looks at ruins but from a, like, you know, public engagement point of view, and he looks at ruins from, you know, romanticizing, and he looks at ruins from, you know, the potential of, like, future decay as well as past decay. You know, there are lots of kind of talks, and that makes you being really alert socially, but architecturally in your field.
And would that be difficult without this platform, without future architecture?
I think yes. Definitely,
you just wouldn't have that access.
No. It gives a visibility and a networking which wouldn't be able before.
Future Architecture isn't just for the benefit of its more youthful participants. The hosting institutions say they gain as well. Danica Jovovic-Prodanovic is one of the organisers of Belgrade International Architecture Week.
It's always good to have international relationships and to build something that was, let's say, stopped in certain moments, end of 90s, etc., etc. But it's a big challenge for the city, and a lot of changes are happening right now around the city. And we as architects, we like to be part of it, but also to comment it, to have a let's say creative discussions on it, and to try to influence these changes that are happening.
We Jesteśmy z Muzeum Architektury i realizujemy na Przedmieściu Ławskim warsztaty, które są częścią takiego większego ogólnoeuropejskiego przedsięwzięcia, które nazywa się Future Architecture Platform. Jest taką
Poland's fourth largest city and its people are looking to architects and urbanists to improve their quality of life. Michal Duda of Wrocław's Architecture Museum says membership of Future Architecture brings a much-needed international perspective to local challenges. That's why he was delighted to work on a project to revive public spaces in a rundown neighborhood with Milanese landscape architect Barbara Boscaroli.
It's very fruitful for us to change the perspective and invite to very tiny local project people who will come with something completely fresh, completely different, maybe not fresh in Milan, but still fresh where we are from. It's also a very nice thing about this new generation of architects that they're coming from the different countries, different cities, but they are not delivering their own ideas and try to implement somewhere abroad. They are very sensitive about the locality, very sensitive about the people from the place where they are acting. That kind of sensitivity is a part of our, I hope it is a part of our future.
Just a couple of introductory remarks. First, also my congratulations to you, the 25 candidates.
This year's festival may be over, but the projects continue, and the Future Architecture Platform has secured EU funding to continue for years to come. If its vision becomes reality, the next generation of architects should be better connected and more in tune with the needs of the people they ultimately serve. And surely, that's a future we can all get behind. For Monocle in Ljubljana, I'm Guy Delaunay.
This is ideology embodied.
Yep. Thank you, Architecture Platform, for having us here.
Great debate. Waiting for the next one.
Thank you for that, Guy. We'll return to Ljubljana later in the show, as the city design biennial enters its final weeks. Now an aside. Last year, an odd-looking pink and yellow limestone building in the City of London became the youngest structure in the UK to be protected for its architectural importance. Dreamed up in the mid-1980s but finished in 1997, Number One Poultry's curiously playful pastiche of styles and frivolous form is one of the best-known examples of the nation's flirtation with post-modern architecture. The unserious style, heavy on colour, borrowed leitmotifs of bygone classicism and much besides, originated in the 1980s as a backlash against those oh-so-serious-looking concrete blocks that some architects saw as blighting the landscape. Writers Geraint Franklin and Elaine Harwood have amassed Britain's best such structures, from Scottish homes that riff playfully on the vernacular of ancient Sparta to Terry Farrell's North London TVAM studios in an enchanting new title, named Postmodern Buildings in Britain. The Batsford published book, produced with the 20th Century Society, casts readers headlong into the wacky and ripe-to-be-rediscovered charms of those playful postmodernists. A thoughtful coda to the publishing glut of rosily written but ultimately boring books about brutalism. Also in our design library this week is The Visual History of Type by Paul McNeil. The ambitiously named title is vast, valuable, and an exhaustive rundown of the particulars of over 300 painstakingly chronicled typefaces. From the fat finials of Gutenberg's first fonts in the 15th century, to the no-nonsense Swiss school, and much lithe ligature and smart script in between, the book has heft to appease the most fastidious of font fanciers, but the lightness of touch to entertain the least type-inclined reader. The metaphorical Section D mailbag is always open to queries and suggestions. Do get in touch by emailing our producer, Ben Ryland. He's at br@monocle.com. For now, this is Section D. Do stay tuned. Next up, we unpick the thorny issue of when architects and designers add their own thumbprint to existing buildings, and, crucially, when renovation means leaving well alone. When the fated hairstylist Vidal Sassoon and his wife Ronnie purchased Richard Neutra's iconic Singleton house in LA back in 2004, the pair were understandably daunted by the dilapidated state of the home, not least when part of the roof collapsed just week before the deal closed. But, knowing they had their hands on architectural gem, they preserved rather than paved over their purchase, choosing to team up with a designer who was equally undeterred by the challenge at hand. The chosen man for the task was Tim Campbell, and his work on the Singleton House is just one of several projects recalled in his tasteful new title, Intentional Beauty. I met Tim recently and began by asking him how it all started.
design chose me. I started drawing at a very young age, and I was much more comfortable with pictures than I was with words for a number of reasons that I talk about in the book with respect to my upbringing and how often we moved. I found myself to drawing pictures at about the age of 4 or 5, picked up a set of Lincoln Logs and started building houses with Lincoln Logs. But it was a profession that in every way chose me.
One thing I'd like to seize on for the moment is this idea of renovation, which I think is a very interesting design challenge because, you know, as much as an architect, it's great to, you know, bulldoze something out of the way and put your own vision on something, we're also, to some extent, the custodians of the built environment that we inherit. I'd love to know how you got into the idea of renovation and how that became such a touchstone for your career as well.
So I've had this incredible audacity of luck to work on some phenomenal houses in the course of my career. The trajectory really kind of started with a hotel in Palm Springs that I was hired to restore, the Colony Palms Hotel, an amazing Spanish hotel that had fallen into disrepair. I was hired by a developer in Los Angeles to restore that property. And while I was doing that, I met Ronnie and Vidal Sassoon, who had just bought the Singleton House in Los Angeles, which is an iconic mid-century house photographed by Julia Shulman. When I was working on the Singleton House with Ronnie and Vidal, a developer approached me and said that he had just purchased a house in Holmby Hills in Los Angeles that had a fountain that was designed by Luis Barragan. And then I went on to work on a project for Diane Keaton, a Ralph Llewellyn house in Beverly Hills. And it just sort of snowballed from there. It was not something that I set out to say I wanted to work on all of these incredibly important and wonderful historic homes, but it showed up on my doorstep. For me, custodian is a very, very important word with respect to these houses because we, especially in the States, it's different in Europe, obviously, we're a younger country, but the idea of restoration and preservation is newer in the States than it is in Europe and in Great Britain. So it's a very important thing to me because we get these structures that hold our history. And they hold memories for the people that have lived in them and the people that built them. And so preserving those has become a sort of a major part of my career path. They're important because I have to speak as an American. We're a young country, right? So we don't have a lot of history that shows us who we were. We certainly don't have a lot of historic buildings that are as markers for who we were and where we came from. So I consider it critical that we act as proper custodians for these buildings. They're incredibly fun to work on. They're incredibly challenging to work on. And they require a sort of discipline about, from my perspective and from the way that I approach them, from not imposing our will on them. In other words, it's more about allowing those buildings to come back to life and to survive and to find out what those buildings want to become if they get to survive for another 100 years or 200 years.
And I agree that preservation can be political in terms of what you decide to do with the building afterwards, what it meant to people in the past, and how that meaning changes over time. I wonder if there are any examples of where you were confronted with a project like this, but you gave it maybe a sort of modern turn where you were able to add a little insignia of your own intervention onto the project. Were there any like that, or are you about doing things faithfully to the way they were before?
I think with each of these houses, in order to make them relevant today, you actually have to impose a little bit of current modernity in them. And the Singleton House, for example, with Ronnie and Vidal Sassoon, the house had a lot of very small bedrooms. The kitchen was in the wrong place. The views from the house, when the house was built in one direction, the view that the house actually sits on the top of a mountain above Los Angeles, or a very large hillside above Los Angeles, the views to the south when the house was built were not very dramatic. The views to the north were of the mountains. And so the kitchen was on the north side of the house. And so there have been moments with all of these houses where I've had to analyze how the setting is different, for example, and reorient the views or reorient how people live within them, within the walls. That's probably a prime example of how far I'm willing to go to impose my will.
Tim Campbell's new book, Intentional Beauty, is published this month. Now back in Slovenia, the Ljubljana Design Biennial is the longest running event of its kind in the world, and it's shaken up its format for its 25th edition. It still isn't afraid to shy away from the past, specifically and appropriately the heritage of the former Yugoslavia. Two of the biennial's 7 projects, or episodes as they're called, deal with relics of the troubled Tito era. Greek architect Pont Supreme tackled the past, present and future of a former mining town and its people. And the French-Portuguese designer Didier Faustino deconstructs the iconic K67 street kiosk, as Guy Delorne reports in his last dispatch from the biennial.
Wander around any town or city in the former Yugoslavia and you'll see them. Most are in a sorry state, used as shelters for security guards or car park attendants. A few are deployed as fast food outlets, and you'll occasionally find some being used as newsstands. These are the remaining K67 kiosks, once a ubiquitous feature of Tito-era cityscapes. And they're the focus of Didier Faustino's episode at the Ljubljana Design Biennial.
And in this project, what was interesting is this kiosk is a kiosk coming from a Soviet period, a kind of communist period. These kiosks were made to make a space of freedom in this country, giving a possibility to individuals to start new business. Architecture has a control of mass. And in this case, communist governments and Tito allowed to the individuals to have in this kiosk possibility to generate individual economies. So it was an interesting point.
The interesting thing is you've picked up, of course, upon one of the sort of main icons of Yugoslav era that was in every cityscape.
Yeah.
Still isn't some of them. You should go to North Mitrovica in the Serb part of Kosovo, and there's a row of them still there.
Yeah.
They're connected very strongly with people's memories. It's also connected strongly with also Slovenian pride because the designer was Slovene.
Yeah.
Are you saying anything about what the icons, the design icons of the future could be for the urban landscape?
I think these icons are icons who are disappearing. They are part of a kind of intimate memory of the country and the population. What I like to talk about this project is these icons should be on one point Frankensteinized to be regenerated, because being an icon without a use, without humanity, it's a dead body. So that's the problem. So how icons can be reintegrated or regenerated inside the society. That's what I'm trying to speak about.
The episode is called Brand New Coexistence, and in Didier Faustino's mischievous hands, the deconstruction of the K67 is entirely literal. He chopped some kiosks in half, turned others on their sides, and installed one in the park next to the Design Museum to see what locals will make of it. In some ways, this seems like a disrespectful way to treat a kiosk which was not only an icon of its age, but also a design classic, an ingenious modular building system which went on display at New York's Museum of Modern Art. But Didier Faustino insists there's a serious intent behind his episode of the Biennial, illustrating the potential for repurposing designs some might consider obsolete.
Why design new things from zero? Let's accept there is many things here we can reactivate. You can see it as a shelter now. Before it was an activity, functional element. Now the fact we reduce it and we make it just kind of the scale inside become more collective. It was also individual, vertical, and now we resize it more horizontal. It became just a shelter and it's a free territory to be occupied. So in terms of our design perspectives is, can we, from existing design, transform it to a new design? And sometimes the role of the designer or the architect or the artist is not to make new, it's to reactivate.
Reactivation can also take human shape. And that's the concept behind another episode at the Biennial. Last month, Primož Roglič became the first ever Slovenian to win a stage of the world's most famous bicycle race, the Tour de France. He made the remarkable transition from world champion junior ski jumper to world-class road racer. His hometown, Trbovlje, is in need of transformation itself. Once, it was a model mining town in the Tito era, but the end of extraction and even operations at its iconic power station have forced people there to consider their identity. To reflect that, Point Supreme architects Konstantinos Pantazis and Mariana Rentsu are opening what they call the Tiny Museum, so the people of Terbovlia can express their passions, from puppetry to poetry and even rocket science. It's part of their biennial episode, After Utopia.
It's a very simple glass, transparent box where people can exhibit their obsessions. People can pass by and easily can see what is exhibited over there. So it's a call to the people of Terbovlia to exhibit their own obsessions.
We're very excited about it because we discovered Utopia hidden in reality. That was what happened. So all these incredible people that do incredible things in their houses on their own, that's the future, that's Utopia.
After the opening in the town, Mariana and Konstantinos have time to reflect on what the biennial has taught them about the people of Terbovlia, how design could affect their lives, and of course, about themselves.
It's crazy things happening behind the closed doors of houses of people that we randomly met. It's very ordinary people doing extremely extraordinary things. So we started to try to list down all the people we met and the interesting things they were doing, or actually amazing things they were doing. And in the end, we ended up with a list of 20 of them. So the project became about exposing those characters, those stories.
Do you think it's changed yourselves as architects, as people who deal with design on a daily basis in your profession? Has the process of doing all this changed you and the way that you think about what you normally do?
For me, at least, the interesting thing that was that we work with different kind of like a writer and a filmmaker, so with a, how do you say?
Profession.
Yeah, sure. Profession. So it was very nice that we could show the same thing, but not from an architecture point of view, but with other mediums. Mm-hmm. That was, for me, very exciting, how you can use other mediums to show up what you want to say.
We focused more on people, and that was very difficult.
Yeah.
So usually we do the same thing, but we focus on space, and that's what we're trained, like architects and designers. But this time we managed to really push aside the idea of the object.
And this is actually a criticism of architects, isn't it? From people
absolutely.
From outside the profession.
Absolutely, yeah. It is, consciously. So it's a conscious statement or a belief we have that we are really trained to think of space and buildings while we, you know, people become the background, the second thing. Well, actually, it's kind of natural because it's much simpler like that. But we have to go back to working with the people as the first thing to look at.
So we've seen the weird and wonderful, not to mention the mysterious and even the mundane, at Bio25. It's consolidated a successful reinvention of the venerable biennial. Visitors no longer gawp at desirable baubles, but need to engage their brains to get the most out of the ideas on offer. Perhaps the most impressive aspect is not any single project or object, but the sense that the process has changed the designers themselves, and, crucially, what they might offer the world in the future. For Monocle in Ljubljana, I'm Guy Delaunay.
Our special thanks to Guy Delaunay for that report. Next week, we'll spend some time with a product design consultant turned watchmaker who'll tell us how his own dream product helped his business tick over nicely.
Whether it be consumer electronics, CMF development, or designing a watch, the workflow and process is very similar.
Section D was produced by Ben Ryland and edited by Sarah Miles. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.